I'd like to welcome everybody to the retreat and also express appreciation to Susan and Karen Cassidy for pulling it together and prodding me into actually giving a retreat. This is the, I think it's the second retreat I've given in California in 12 years. So. of course, the theme is metta, loving kindness, and but the context is a retreat, is a whole sort of practice situation, and I think we're taking the opportunity to explore the different expressions of loving kindness, the development of loving kindness, the implications of loving kindness, and sometimes it's there's retreats get built as a metta retreat, and I don't know what they teach on it, but I don't know what I'm going to teach on it either. The way, as I understand it, there's really not a, you can't sort of extract loving kindness out of the Buddha's teachings, and it's some sort of orphan that stands alone somewhere. It doesn't really work that way. It's like you pick up a corner of the Buddha's teachings, and everything comes along with it, including metta. It's like I pick up this little tassel here, and of course, so everything starts coming up, and pretty soon everything's attached. So it and the cushion, the bell, everything sort of comes along with it. So the teachings of loving kindness are actually in a whole context and a whole setting, and I think the opportunity for us to come together and practice in this setting, we'll be able to explore that. Of course, one of the most important sort of foundation or ground for any aspect of the teachings to arise out of is just what we've done, refuges and precepts. It's not just a curious little ceremony that you begin a retreat with and that's the end of it. It's the whole aspect of refuges, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, providing the foundation for the wholesome qualities of the heart to start to arise, and of course the precepts to establish a strong foundation of integrity, virtue, and an ability to cultivate either personally or in a group setting, a sense of Well, a sense of trust, both a trust in oneself and a trust in the kind of whole environment that one is in, and that's where so many of the wholesome qualities have an opportunity to arise out of. And reflecting and recollecting the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha as refuges are always an important a basis or a reminder for ourselves. Because the reality is we're actually always taking refuge in something. You know, whether it's taking refuge in some distraction or taking refuge in some particular worry, fear, anxiety of the moment, or pet peeve that the mind goes into it, and that's where we create our refuge. We rely on it. We build our life around it, and of course, it's not a very satisfying refuge, of course, but it's what we do as human beings. It's like Ajahn Chah's definition of what a human being is. A human being is a being with issues. It's always having an issue with something or other, and it keeps us busy, you know. Gives us something to live for, you know. And then we die. So it goes on and on. Redirecting our attention to something that is really a worthy refuge. The Buddha as a historical figure, the Buddha as a symbol, and certainly the symbol of the qualities which the Buddha symbolizes: wisdom, compassion, purity. These are fundamental qualities. It's like in the morning chanting when which we do at the monastery every day, pretty much, and the first line of one of the chants: Buddho Susuto Karuna Manavo. That's Buddho is the one who knows, one with wisdom. Susuto is purity. Suti, or Parisuti is purity. Mahaguruna, great compassion. Or even when we the recitation, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa, those are referring to those qualities of the Bhagava is Bhagavato is a blessed one. So it's the blessing of compassion, the heart quality of compassion. Arahato, one who is far from defilements, the sense of purity, far from the defiling tendencies. Sammasambuddhasa, the self-enlightened, the sense of the wisdom quality. So throughout the traditional recollections of the Buddha is these referencing to these qualities of wisdom, compassion, purity, and of course those are not qualities which are reserved to the Buddha, but that the Buddha is the is sort of the archetype of what is most fruitful for us to cultivate, for us to be paying attention to, for us to create a balance within the heart with. So those qualities of wisdom, compassion, purity are the qualities which we cultivate, pay attention to. If we were reflecting, how's our practice doing? How's our life going? What was it? Are these qualities being attended to? Are they being? Is one sort of out of balance? Is one sort of missing something? Is something? How to reconfigure that? Or to pay attention to? So those aspects of the qualities of the Buddha. The Dhamma being truth, the teachings in the conventional sense, and then the sort of the truth of existence underlying that there are fundamental truths that we're able to realize, understand, penetrate, and when those truths are seen, understood, they have a transformative quality to them. And it's also the something that say the Buddha himself said, that whether a Buddha arises in the world or a Buddha doesn't arise in the world, there is still this underlying nature of things. All things of a compounded nature are impermanent. All things of a compounded nature are unsatisfactory. All dhammas, all things are not self. It's helpful when a Buddha comes along and points it out. That is the underlying truth. That's the way things are. And that is something that we can direct our attention to. And there is these fundamental truths which we can realize. And the Sangha as a refuge on a conventional level, and the having ordained people who have stepped out of the world, have made a commitment to spiritual practice and training. This is a helpful tool to have, these examples. They just say this is this retreat. Some of the many of the people who are on this retreat are familiar with us, and some may not be. It's an opportunity to get a bit of a flavor of having, ordained Sangha this is going to also sort of build as a monastic retreat in the sense of following, having the monastic Sangha here. We have our own particular perspectives. Some people find it useful. Some people, it's not everybody's cup of tea. But it, it has a flavor. But also, when the Buddha refers to Sangha, on a more, say, outside of the conventional level, then it's also pointing to qualities, qualities of the heart. So that when in the chant that we do, recollecting Sangha, Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho, say the Sangha of the Blessed Ones, disciples are those who practice well, Supatipanno, those who practice well, Uchupatipanno, those who practice directly, Nyaya Patipanno, those who practice for the overcoming of suffering, understanding, for knowledge, Samiji Patipanno, those who practice with integrity or practice appropriately. And those are qualities which are, say, the qualities of those who have entered into the say, fruition of the path, the stream entry, once return or non-return, arahant. These are that's the nature of those who have entered into the fruits of the path. That's so that they on a transcendent level, those are the qualities. And when we come together to practice in a retreat situation, the taking on of the 8 precepts for the duration of the retreat is an opportunity to, well, one is it's there's a simplification that takes place there, having the 8 precepts as a foundation. But also there's a very interesting discourse that the Buddha gave. It was to Visakha. It was one of the foremost female disciples of the Buddha during the Buddha's time, and he was praising the keeping of the lunar observance days, so that they for the lay community keeping the once a week keeping a lunar observance day. It's in Pali, it's called the Uposatha. And the Buddha highlighting the say the frame, because the traditionally one of the things a lay community would do would be to take the 8 precepts. You'd take them in the morning, keep them for a day and a night, and that would be an observance. And the way the Buddha described it is saying that those noble ones, those arahants who are fully enlightened, they live their whole life not harming, not taking life of any living creature. So for the lay people, for a day and a night to be able to live just like an arahant, and not take the life of any living creature. And saying that those arahants, those fully enlightened beings, they live the whole life not taking what isn't given. Saying not stealing, committed to honesty. So for a day and a night to be able to live just like an enlightened being, refraining from taking that which is not given. So in the same way, through the 8 precepts, that structure, this is basically how an enlightened being is, that's how they live, that's how the kind of the hardwired structure. So for us to come together and to have a period of a week practicing together, it's a very special opportunity. Giving oneself the opportunity, because sometimes there's sort of there's not much reflection on, you know, when you ask somebody how'd the retreat go, they'll always say, mind was all over the place. Oh, there was this ache and pain, or there was this, and there was that, and I was like, nobody sort of said, I lived for a week, just simplicity, and I was just living like the noble ones. It was great. it sort of ends up as me and my mind. This is good. Hopelessly enmeshed in it. Just to be able to say, I've got this opportunity to live really simply for this week. Isn't that great? And it's no small thing. It's really it has a wonderful effect. You know, plus the fact that we're doing it in a kind of idyllic heavenly world here. It's just it's the lovely forest. So having this opportunity to come together, practice together, having taken on the refuges and precepts, to have this time to practice meditation, walking meditation, sitting meditation. Again, the theme is loving kindness, and I would encourage everybody, to approach this whole time together and this time of practice approach the practice with a sphere, within the sphere of loving kindness. Walking meditation, sitting meditation to bring that quality of kindness up. And traditionally, the first person that one in the sort of classical modes of cultivation of loving kindness, the first person that one generates loving kindness towards is oneself. And so just be kind to yourself during this period of retreat time. It's the opportunity to have time for solitude like this, quiet like this, the opportunity to cultivate mindfulness, the opportunity to cultivate a continuity of awareness in the meditation, the sitting meditation, the walking meditation. That's a great opportunity. And enjoy it. don't tie yourselves up in knots. It's the quality of I think, loving kindness, again, it can't really be separated from the Dhamma or separated from anything else. So that they, um, those qualities of say, of letting go, of non-contention, you know, that's where loving kindness arises out of, when we can, we let go of our moods or obsessions or worries or fears. Well, what's left? Oh, well, there's loving kindness. When there's not a, one isn't contending and struggling and fighting and, you know, feeling oneself in opposition to either the weather, the circumstances around one, the people that one's with, or with oneself internally, when we're, there's just that, there's that non-contention, that non-struggle, that non-irritation. There's a quality of loving kindness is able to arise quite naturally. It's just it's a natural result. So that the in our meditation, to really review how we're holding the meditation. Because we begin the practice as we're sitting, just to really take the time to establish the kind of the recollection, the context of sitting here, just relaxing the body, relaxing the kind of awareness, where am I holding, where am I tightening? Okay, let's just relax, just have a, take a couple minutes sweeping through the body, paying attention. Okay, let's just relax here, let's just get settled. Okay, breath coming in, breath going out, tuning into the breath, and allowing that feeling of settling to establish itself, and then the establishing a continuity of awareness with the object of meditation. Generally, my approach to meditation, I imagine that there's people have, everybody that's here is has experience in meditation already, and people will have their own particular methods that they're comfortable with or familiar with. My own inclination or my own ease of familiarity is with mindfulness of breathing. So if I'm giving instruction, I'll almost invariably be using that as a framework in the formal meditation. But if one's using a different object for some reason, it's very easy to just extrapolate the instruction for mindfulness of breathing and turn it to whatever method, technique that each individual uses. You know, walking meditation, very similar. Again, just finding a comfortable spot where there's, whether there's, if one likes shade, be in the shade. If you like being in the sun, be in the sun. It's the a path that's, it feels, that's one that's nice and level, and it's long enough that one feels comfortable with 20 paces, 25, 30 paces, whatever. If it's too long, you tend to, you know, it's easy for the mind to start wandering. But that having a certain container, if it's too short and you're sort of going back and forth all the time, it's difficult to get settled. So just finding something that's comfortable for you. But I think that's the kind of underlying theme is, okay, well, how to make it comfortable. Just make it something that is, there's a sort of ease that one is bringing into the practice, whether it's the walking or sitting, or if you like standing meditation. You can do standing meditation. And Carl is forced to do lying meditation. They're getting a lot of lying meditation in. But that's it's not so much the posture or the method, sort of how do you approach the establishing of the mind, that bringing up attention, attentiveness to the object of meditation, sustaining a continuity, and then working with that. Where's the mind go? Does it drift? And does it get sort of loose and nebulous, or does it get honing in on the minutiae of the mind and get tied up with it and get tight? These pay attention to what the mind is doing, and that's that, because the quality of balance is just an important quality to be bringing into the practice, and how to best sustain that continuity of awareness, because that's where the mind becomes peaceful. It doesn't become peaceful just by forcing the mind onto an object and holding it there, because even if you succeed in doing that, it doesn't actually make the mind that peaceful. The mind to really settle, there needs to be a balance of interested application, a kind of an application of energy, and an ease with how we're holding it. And then the mind will be able to settle that way. So that there's too much forcing, or it's too kind of loose and sort of a bit, the mind gets a bit nebulous and cloudy, then it drifts. Working with what is the balance for the mind. So whether it's sitting, walking, standing, lying down, that's where that continuity starts to really kind of kick in and allow the mind to settle. And all of these postures are valid. That's where when the Buddha talks about meditation or cultivation of mindfulness, is around all four postures, and it's important, essential to develop that continuity in the different postures. I remember the first year I was a monk, and the evening meeting at the monastery that I was at was they did a bit of chanting. It was either at the beginning or at the end, but it would be an hour sitting, hour standing, hour walking. That would be the evening meeting. And it was an hour each. And you think, I remember it first, you know, when it was started. Wow, great, they do standing meditation. Man, that's going to be good. My knees kill me when I'm sitting. Yeah. You realize it's just the pain goes somewhere else. As you get. So in practice, you realize, well, it's the actual relaxing around the pain or the discomfort that is, and the kind of kindness. Well, that's what bodies do. You know, they get uncomfortable. Lying down meditation. It was one rains retreat. I can't remember how many years I was a monk then, probably, I don't know, 15 or 20 years as a monk. But there was, I had a whole several months of lying meditation because I'd fractured my pelvis, so I wasn't doing anything else. But I was in a very quiet, peaceful surrounding. I was able to lobby with, and the doctor was also a supporter of the monastery, so I was able to. He sprung me out of the hospital and got me back to the monastery. So could be out there. I said, well, I'm going to be, whether I'm in the hospital or whether I'm in the monastery, I'm going to be lying down anyway. So I'll be a lot happier out there. Then you realize, yeah, it's the awareness, it's the continuity of awareness, it's the attention, the quality of attention that we pay to things, and it's not the getting a particular posture down or getting a particular technique down. The techniques, the postures, the external things, these are they're essential, they're necessary. You need to develop an efficacy with it, but they're tools, and it's how you use the tool. That's important. So that during this week that we have here, paying attention, okay, how am I holding the meditation? How am I holding the perception? How am I holding my body? How am I holding the things that are coming up in my own mind? How am I holding the perceptions that I have of the people around me? Those are just because that's what's really important. That's where you the mind can go into, especially say a metta retreat. In the same way, in a meditation retreat, and say, "Well, it's like all those other people are peaceful. I don't know how come I'm not peaceful. They seem to be all they're all so still and peaceful because everybody else is thinking the same thing. You know, the same as oh, God, all these other people look like they're really happy and kind. They're getting that loving kindness bit. You know, how come?" Obviously not getting it. Taking loving kindness as a theme, and then then what comes up is just how irritating the world is. So there. But it doesn't really matter. how are we holding it? How are we? What is actually coming up in the mind? And And how are we relating to it? What are we, how are we layering our experience? So that the, that's where the kindness is. Okay. Having that, that sense of non-contention, letting go. This is what's coming up. Oh, that can be let go of. I don't, okay, this is what's coming up. Well, I don't have to contend with that. Okay. Back to the breath. Back to the walking. Back to that continuity of awareness. So these are a few reflections to begin the retreat with. We could continue with the sitting. Also, just a note to you probably, there's already probably been mentioned, but I thought I would maybe say something myself in that the way I'll be structuring the teachings is that I'll at this period of say 1:30 beginning the afternoon session I'll give some teachings I'll in the morning beginning the morning session I'll give some teachings at 8:30 and then in as we begin the evening session I'd like to begin that with a question and answer session. And so if anybody has any questions, please write them down, and I can use that as a means of addressing any questions, queries, doubts, whether it's about something that I've said or taught or something that is you think would be useful within your own practice. I won't be doing personal interviews during this time. My health hasn't been so great this past year, so my energy is really, sometimes I got good energy and sometimes I don't. And when my energy goes down, then it's gone. My default option has always been, well, if my energy goes down, then you just plow through it, you know, so you don't stop. But that's not working anymore. not during this time. So because I'm not sure I would have the energy to do the interviews or how would I be after them, then I thought, well, we'll put it into a pool of a group sort of interview. So if anybody has any questions, we can use that as a... And I, on a certain level, I mean, I think everybody benefits that way. It isn't as if, you know, we have absolutely unique, special. circumstance, just me. So that, yeah, it's a benefit to everybody. And my energy tends to dwindle more in the, toward the end of the day, so do more teachings during the day, and I've always found it a bit curious that in the tradition you give the talk at night, and but there you give the talk at night, and everybody goes to bed. So I think, I give the talk in the day, and then we've got things to work with through the day.